Well, let me add my thanks to the worship team for leading us. You guys did a great job, and it's a really real privilege to have you here with us. So I want to extend my welcome to you as well, and to any family members and friends who are here to support you. Blessings and grace to you this morning. I would say that one of the things that we really love to do here in our congregation is to give people opportunities to explore and develop their gifts. And so we're happy to give you a chance to practice with us, and I'm glad that you blessed us. You guys are pretty far along, so we're delighted to celebrate with you. The one song that we sang this morning, I just realized, is just really impressing me lately. I think we sang this maybe last week or the week before, the song about the Holy Spirit. And the phrase that just, the two phrases that stood out to me was, "Let us become more aware of your presence." Let's just keep praying that one. And I don't know if I had the words right for the next one because it went away too fast, but I think it says, "Let us experience the glory of your goodness." Isn't that a lovely phrase? Let us experience the glory of your goodness. And may that be true for all of us, no matter where you attend church. But I'm especially asking that of the Lord for our congregation. May we experience the glory of your goodness. Wow. Well, happy Easter again to you as well. This is the fifth Sunday of the Easter season, and so we continue to celebrate, and I was pleased to see some echoes of the resurrection in the songs that we sang, and we continue in the series that we're in, the But God series, and that's what our display is about here in the front, the word but here on the left and the word God on the right for you. In this series, we're talking about looking at ways that God surprises us, the ways that God surprises us, so the writers in the Bible say, "This was happening, but God stepped in, and then that happened." And so we're reviewing some things that are maybe things you kind of have a sense are generally true, but I'm drawing particular emphasis to them because I think it's important for us to understand them clearly and to ground our understanding in the Scriptures. So today what I want to do is pick up on a theme I've been in the last two sermons I've preached, the notion that God knows. Three Sundays ago, I think I preached a sermon called "But God Knows." And I talked about how God knows our inner secrets. God knows what we're thinking. And that means that God knows what the people around us are thinking as well. It also means that God knows the future. God knows what's coming. And so last week and this week, I'm looking at two implications of that. Last week, we looked at the story of Abraham and Sarah. And we heard God say to Abraham, "Don't be so distressed. You know, why are you so distressed about the situation that you're in? I know what's happening and I know what's coming. I know what to do." And today I want to look at the story of Joseph for a related observation, a related implication of God's knowledge of the future and God's knowledge of our inner workings. And at the risk of distracting you, I want to give you a puzzle here at the beginning that I'll only solve at the end. And that is, as I talk about Joseph, I want to suggest that there are two major Old Testament characters about whom really nothing negative is said. You know, many of the characters in the Old Testament, there's sort of their good side and their bad side, their strengths and their failings. But there are two main characters about whom I don't think anything really of major significance that's negative is written about them. One of them is Joseph, and the other one is for you to think about. So, some of you won't hear anything else I say until I answer that question, but I'll take that risk. This morning, I want to look at the story of Joseph with you in the later chapters of Genesis. I want us to look at how God's knowledge of our secrets and of the future impact our lives as that plays out in the story of Joseph, and especially focusing on how we often overlook or how often we're unaware of God, how God is at working redemption and deliverance in our lives right now, that often God is at work in ways we can't really see because we're not tuned into things the way God is. Now, many of you know the story of Joseph, but I'm just going to summarize it for you briefly. Joseph was the firstborn son of Jacob and Rachel, the first son born to Rachel, who was Jacob's favorite wife. Rachel seemed to be unable to conceive, while her sister Leah gave birth to six sons and a daughter. Leah gave birth to six sons, which in the time was, each one was like a trophy, like a triumph. And if you do the math, I don't know exactly how it worked back then, but probably similar to the way it does now, that took at least 7 years and probably more like 8, 10, or 12 for Leah to give birth to seven children. And all that time, her sister Rachel is unable to conceive and is carrying the deeper and deeper pain of infertility. This is a great disappointment to Rachel and to Jacob as well. And since we're talking about this on Mother's Day, I thought I would just give you a side note here that maybe for some of you would be interesting, you would want to pursue this in another study. I think it's just very interesting how often the women and the mothers who are most central to God's purposes in the stories in the Bible struggle with being overlooked, with being mistreated, with being unable to have children. If you think about it, many of the women who are central to God's purposes struggle with those things. And so if those are things that you struggle with right now, I hope it's at least some measure of comfort to you know that the women, the female heroes of our faith story, know something of the pain and the disappointment and the loss that you're experiencing and that you struggle with, your sense of longing. Clearly, Rachel was one of those characters. And then, in chapter 30 of Genesis, it says, God remembered Rachel. It doesn't mean that God forgot about her before that, like he kind of lost track of Rachel out there. It means that he decided to have mercy on her in a new way, just like he had been having mercy on her sister Leah. It says that the reason Leah was able to give birth to sons early and ahead of Rachel was that she was kind of overlooked and disregarded in some ways by her husband. But what Rachel says when Joseph is born, her firstborn son, she says, God has taken away my disgrace. God has taken away my disgrace. And she names him Joseph, which if you look at your footnotes says, it means the word Joseph in Hebrew means, may he add. So if Rachel had given birth today, we'd have a little boy here in our congregation called may he add. May he add. That's what Joseph means. But what she's really saying is, this is great. I want more, right? I mean, she's waited so long for a son, and she names Joseph as a kind of a declaration of praise, but also, let's keep this going, God. I want more sons. Chapter 37 says that Joseph was Jacob's favorite son. In verse 3, it says that Jacob loved him more than any of his other sons. You can probably imagine how excited his brothers were about that. Joseph, if you do the math, Joseph was the 11th son. Now, in most families, especially in this time, the firstborn son is really the focus. And then there's a little bit of glory and amazement left for the second and a little bit less left for the third. But by the time you get down to number 11, they're just sort of at the end of the tale, right? So all those 10 brothers who came before him have to watch Jacob lavishing affection on Joseph. And it didn't really go well with them. Verse 4 in chapter 37 says, his brothers hated him and could not speak a kind word to him. They just hated the guy. He was this annoying little brother, and their dad, for whatever reason they didn't fully understand, was just infatuated with this young boy. Their hatred was so strong that one day, when he was about 17 or 18, his brothers seized the opportunity to get rid of him. To just get rid of him. Some of them wanted to kill him. But then slightly cooler heads prevailed, and they just sold him into slavery. And they told Joseph that Jacob had been killed, and they thought they had closed the door on Joseph. That was their goal. They sold him into slavery to get rid of him and to close the door on this business. Now, if you're familiar with this story, you probably just are just cruising along. Yeah, I sold to slavery. What's next? Blah, blah. But put yourself in their shoes. This is nasty business. I mean, I'm sure that some of you have been annoyed with a brother or sister, but you've probably never sold them into slavery. They wanted to kill it. I mean, this is serious business. They're changing Joseph's life. They're playing for keeps here. And they still lied to their father and broke his heart. Broke his heart. And they had no way to know how Joseph would be treated in slavery. I mean, if you know anything about slavery in the ancient world, it was not pretty. For all we know, they were thinking, oh, these guys will take care of our dirty work. They'll kill him. They certainly would have known he would have been mistreated. So Joseph is sold into slavery. He lives as a slave. But he's also a very capable young man. Chapter 39 says, the Lord was with Joseph and gave him success in everything he did. And so in some period of time, somewhat short order, he's promoted within the slave ranks in his master's household. And he's given responsibility of all of his master's household. Which to us sounds pretty good. I mean, we think, okay, that's better. But again, think about this from Joseph's perspective. Joseph has been sold into slavery. At 18 years old, he's been torn away from the only world he's ever known, as far as we know. He's torn away from his extended family, sent into a country that, as far as we know, he had never in before, in a strange culture, strange situation, and he's a slave. Now, how many of us would be in that situation and not think, what's going on? Why me? What did I ever do to deserve such a disaster in my life? Where is God? What, you know, is God aware what's going on here? And yet somehow this young man whose immaturity led to the way he was, you know, provoking his brothers. I don't think he realized probably quite what he's doing. Well, maybe he did. Younger brothers have a way of pushing their older brothers' buttons, I know. But somehow his immaturity that had so annoyed his older brothers, he was able, in spite of that, in this time of slavery, he was able to become a trustworthy and honorable young man. Just think about that for a minute. He was able to say no to wrongdoing when a real temptation presented it to him. But somehow, in the midst of the trials of his life, he found a way to trust in God, to be a trustworthy and honorable young man. Well, as you know, if you know the story, he was then falsely accused by his master's wife, which led to him being thrown into prison. Even there, it says the Lord was with him and granted him favor in the eyes of the warden. And so just like in the household where he was given responsibility, so too in the prison. He was given responsibility over other prisoners. But he was forgotten in prison. He spent several years in prison. He was forgotten by his former master. He was forgotten by men that he helped in prison. Years are passing here. When you read it, you can read it in a sitting, but years of this young man's life are passing by, and he's stuck in prison. And again, I'm thinking, at some point it has to cross his mind, where is God? What is God doing? Has he forgotten about me? And then one day he's called out of prison into the presence of the most powerful man in the world, the Pharaoh of Egypt, the most powerful nation in the world at that time. Joseph is brought into his presence because the Pharaoh wants to understand a dream that he's had. At this point, many years have passed since he's been carried off to Egypt. But his character has been developed enough to have some level of humility. When he comes to Pharaoh, Pharaoh says, I need you to interpret my dream. And Joseph says, I can't interpret dreams, but God can. And maybe God will give me the interpretation, which he does. And as a result of interpreting Pharaoh's dream, Pharaoh gives him an unimaginable level of power and authority in Egypt. It says that he was given authority second only to Pharaoh himself, which, you know, it's just an incredible outcome. An example, I think, of God's creativity. We've been talking about God's power, God's imagination, and God's creativity and the way he works those for our good. I think this is an illustration of that. Nobody saw this coming except for God. Chapter 41 says that Joseph was only 30 years old when he was given that authority. He was only 30 years old when he was given that level of position. But if he was 18 when he was sold into slavery, 17 or 18, that means 12 years have passed. 12 years of the life of a young man, very formative years. And he's been in prison and in slavery all that time. But again, somehow, his trust, his ability to trust God has deepened his integrity, strengthened his resolve to honor God. And so he moves into this position of power and authority, and he's assembling, he's a wealthy person, he becomes wealthy quickly, he's given a wife, he's at the top of his game at 30 years old, he has nothing, he wants for nothing. But then one day, I think he faces an even bigger challenge to his character than he's ever faced before, because the brothers who sold him into slavery appear before him needing his help. His brothers, the very same men who hated him so much that they jumped at the chance to destroy his life, are laying down on the floor in front of him. They don't know it's him, but they're down there. He's got full power over these guys. Now, Genesis doesn't say this, but I think that Joseph, if I put myself in his shoes, I think he had to figure out what to do with them. I think he had to figure out how to respond. And if you've ever been in a position to even the score with somebody who has harmed you, who has betrayed you, who has caused you profound pain, you know the temptation that I'm sure Joseph was facing. Joseph had every right and he had all the power, you know, that could, all the physical power you could muster. He could have done anything he wanted with these brothers to make them squirm, to embarrass them. I think you may understand that temptation if you've ever been in the position to get revenge. He toys with them. He plays games with them. He uses his power to confuse them and to scare them. And again, I think he's trying to figure out what to do with them. Maybe trying to figure out who they are now. This is probably almost 20 years later. When they return several months later, they've used up the original supply of grain he sends home with them. They come back to him. He continues to toy with them, continues to test them. And he does so by threatening the life of his younger brother, Benjamin. But I think there's a major shift in the story when he does that, because what happens is that Judah, the fourth son, steps forward and says, "Egyptian official, please don't threaten the life of Benjamin. Take my life instead. Take me as ransom from my younger brother Benjamin. It would destroy our father if something happened to Benjamin." And you know what's interesting is Judah is the one who is named in the earlier chapter as the one whose idea it was to sell Joseph into slavery in the first place. He's named as the person who had that idea, and now he's the one who is stepping forward in a kind of redemptive capacity for Benjamin, saying, "Take my life instead of his. Don't do this." And I think, I'm reading this into the story, but I think that maybe that was the moment of some kind of shift for Joseph. And he realized that I have changed, but my brothers have changed too. And we're in a new moment. And I think maybe that's the moment at which he understood more fully what we read about in chapter 45. And I'm going to read to you from chapter 45 what happens next. His brothers are there. Judah has just stepped forward and said, "Take my life instead of Benjamin's." Genesis 45 verse 1 says, "Then Joseph could no longer control himself before all his attendants, and he cried out, 'Have everyone leave my presence.' So there was no one with Joseph when he made himself known to his brothers, and he wept so loudly that the Egyptians who were outside the room," evidently, they were outside the room, "he wept so loudly that they could hear him outside. And Pharaoh's household, even Pharaoh's household, heard about it. Joseph said to his brothers, 'I am Joseph. Is my father still living?' But his brothers were not able to answer him." This is a little comedy in the story here. "His brothers were not able to answer him because they were terrified at his presence." Of course they are. This is the second most powerful man in the world. And he somehow brings this name Joseph up that maybe they've talked about for a while, but they thought the door was closed. They probably thought he was dead. And this Egyptian is saying that he's Joseph. Of course they were speechless and terrified. It says they were terrified at his presence. He's just announced some connection to their deepest secret, and he's the most, second most powerful man in the world. "Joseph said to his brothers," verse 4, "'Come close to me.' When they had done so, he said, 'I am your brother Joseph, the one you sold into slavery. And now do not be distressed.'" That's an interesting phrase. Then we just hear that last week, God saying to Abraham, "Do not be so distressed." His brother, or Joseph, is now saying to his brothers, "Don't be distressed and do not be angry with yourselves for selling me here, because it was to save lives that God sent me ahead of you." Did you notice the shift there? He says, "You sold me into slavery," but he also says, "God sent me here." Isn't that interesting? "You sold me into slavery, but God sent me here." Joseph is, it's making sense to Joseph on a new level here. For two years there has been famine in the land, and for the next 5 years there will be no plowing and reaping." Actually, that probably means that Joseph was about 32 at this point, because if he was 30, well, anyway, I'll let you do the math. I can't do that on my feet. "For 2 years now there's been famine in the land. For the next 5 years there will be no plowing and reaping, but God sent me ahead of you." Again, "God sent me ahead of you to preserve for you a remnant on earth and to save your lives by a great deliverance. So then it was not you who sent me here, but God. But God sent me here. He made me father to Pharaoh, lord of his entire household, and ruler of all Egypt. Now hurry back to my father and say to him, This is what your son Joseph says. God has made me Lord of all Egypt. Come down to me and don't delay. You shall live in the region of Goshen and be near me, you, your children and your grandchildren, your flocks and your herds and all you have. I will provide for you here. I will provide for you there in Goshen, because 5 years of famine are still to come. Otherwise, you and your household and all who belong to you will become destitute. You can see for yourselves, and so can my brother Benjamin, that it is really I who am speaking to you. Tell my father about all the honor accorded me in Egypt and about everything you have seen, and bring my father down here quickly. Then he threw his arms around his brother Benjamin and wept, and Benjamin embraced him weeping, and he kissed all his brothers and wept over them. What an amazing story and scene. Long before Jacob and his family had any idea that they were headed into trouble, God knew. God knew what was coming. God could see into the future. They couldn't see it, but God did, and God knew what to do. I don't know that I would say that God made Joseph's brothers sell him into slavery, but Joseph's visions or dreams about the future took place before that. So clearly God was seeing into the future and providing for Joseph, and he knew what was coming. He knew what to do. And I would certainly say that God redeemed the circumstances of Joseph's life as Joseph trusted him and continued to honor him. I also thought as I was working on these notes that, you know, what would have happened if Joseph had turned instead to bitterness, to anger, toward hatred toward God? I mean, how many of us would have had the capacity to do what he did, to remain faithful and trust in God in the face of all of that adversity? Last week we said about Abraham's story that God was not distressed by Abraham's situation. God was not troubled by Abraham's situation. And this week my simple observation for you, my implication for you, is that we usually understand God's direction more clearly in hindsight. We usually understand God's direction in our lives more clearly in hindsight than we do in trying to figure out exactly what God is doing in our present, or in trying to look ahead to understand exactly what God's going to do in the future. We have ideas. We have ideas and we have promises, but in figuring out exactly what God is up to, that's a lot easier to do as we look back on our story and we say, oh, that's what God was doing. I think we're like Joseph in that way. Now again, this might, like I said last week, this observation might seem absurdly simple to you, and I forgive you if that's what you think, but I think it bears pondering. It's a profound observation. And I think it's an important one to bear in mind as we seek to be faithful in trusting God in uncertain times, in the uncertain times in which we live our lives often. I just want to invite you to ponder that and to think about it in terms of your own journey and to be challenged to be faithful and to keep trusting God, to keep honoring his call in our lives, regardless of how challenging our circumstances may be. Because I think when you think about the story of Joseph, there is just no way that he knew when his brothers sold him into slavery, when he was falsely accused and thrown into prison, when he was forgotten in prison. There is no way that as each of those steps unfolded that Joseph knew, okay, I know God's going to make me the second highest ruler in Egypt in just a few years. I just need to endure this. No, there's no evidence that God told him that's what was happening. He just walked through these things. Just walked through them. And yet somehow, at least part of what God was doing was he was developing maturity and character in Joseph's life so that when the moment came that he was given this incredible responsibility, he was ready for it. He had the maturity to bear up under that kind of responsibility and not be manipulative and not be self-focused, not be abusive with people, because he knew that all of what he had, he had because God had provided to him. I think it only became clear to him when his brothers came back to him to the second time and he had that interaction with Judah. I think it only became clear to him in that moment that God had been with him. God had been providing for him and that God was at work as well in addition to the reality of his circumstances. I just am struck by how Joseph became a faithful, trustworthy, humble man with deep integrity, even though he had no personal contact, as far as we know, with his family, and even though he'd been torn away from the faith, the roots of his faith, the faith roots that he, that nurtured him and gave birth. He had no contact with them for at least 15, maybe 20 years. And yet, all this time later, we find him to be trustworthy, a man of integrity, and ready for that kind of responsibility. And honestly, I'm not sure I would have passed that test. If I had been torn away from my family, from my faith roots at 18, and gone through the kind of adversity he did, and at 38, you know, resurfaced in some way, I think I would have been beaten down by those circumstances. I would love to hope that maybe I wouldn't, but Joseph's example here is really incredible in that regard. But somehow then he's able to say here in verse 7 that we looked at, we're in a jam here, times are tough, but God was already at work in ways that we could not possibly have understood along the way to save us and to deliver us. I think one of the questions for us that comes from this story is, are you peacefully trusting God? Are you able to trust God? Trust that God is at work right now in your life and in your circumstances, even if you don't know exactly how God is at work or exactly what God is doing. Even though God may seem silent or far away right now in your life, will you trust that God is at work? Even if you don't know how he is or what he's doing. I've learned something about this in my own life. There have been two different times in our life together that Nita and I have moved to a different state for what we thought was one reason. But when our time there was concluding and we look back on our time there, we ended up realizing that maybe God had sent us there for an additional reason. The first time that this happened was early in our married life. 6 weeks after we got married, we moved to Ann Arbor, Michigan, so I could work through the doctoral program in sociology there at the University of Michigan. I thought I was moving there. I thought we were moving there so I could be trained in the field of sociology. I thought that I was being trained to work in that field and to prepare for a life of teaching and research. And all of that did happen. All of that did happen. I did receive that training, and the training I got there changed my vocational life permanently. Everything I've done since in a work setting has been directly impacted by that time. What I did not realize when we moved to Ann Arbor was that I was also going to experience a profound spiritual crisis while we were there. So just like I went through a profound sort of professional training experience, I also went through a profound spiritual crisis while we were in Ann Arbor, but that I would also experience an equally profound adult conversion, a reconversion, you might say, at age 25. But that when that unfolded in my life, we would be surrounded by friends and by Christian believers who would walk through those dark days with us and who would provide encouragement and training in Christian leadership as I emerged on the other side of that crisis and my reconversion. Now, I don't want you to misunderstand. I had been a sincere follower of Jesus in high school and college. I was a very devoted follower of Christ. I was very regular in reading the scriptures and prayer, helped to organize service opportunities and done some speaking and so on. And part of the joy of that time for me was at Lancaster Mennonite High School here. That was a season in my life that I just was blossomed in new ways. And so that was all very true of my story. But at a certain point in graduate school, I started wondering if my faith journey was more about the family I had been born into and all the settings I'd lived in than it was about the truth of the Christian gospel. And so I realized I didn't really have simple, quick answers to that question. And so slowly for me, the energy for reading the Bible and praying and going to church started fading, and I started dropping those practices. And those things kind of dried up for me. I began skipping the small group meetings that we were part of. But you know, one of the strange things about that year for me was that at a certain point, an intuition came to mind for me that God was at work in my life. It wasn't a spoken word from God, and it wasn't anything that someone else said to me. I just had this sense that occurred to me one day that, you know what, you don't have to be frantic about this troubled time in your life. God is at work. That somehow God was rearranging things in me. God was reorienting some things, straightening out some things. That even though, yeah, it was real, I was going through difficulty, but that somehow God was at work. And so at a certain level, I just said, okay, I don't understand that. I don't know how that's happening. It doesn't make any sense to me rationally. I don't know exactly what God is doing, but if that's true, I'll let God do that. Now, I don't want to suggest that my difficulties would even have registered on Joseph's scale, you know, the kind of things I listed for you that happened to Joseph. But what I will say is that in retrospect, I think God had a specific spiritual reason for us to be in Ann Arbor in addition to the vocational reason that took me there. And as I look back on it, I'm as grateful for the spiritual journey that unfolded for me there as I am for the vocational journey that I was on when we were in Ann Arbor. I think God was doing more than I realized at the time. He knew what I needed. He knew what the future held. He directed us in ways that we could only see clearly after the fact. And what happened, I think I've told some of the story before, at a certain point I did some reading about the resurrection, became very firmly convinced of the truth of Jesus' physical resurrection, and it was around that core conviction that I was able to rebuild my trust in the Lord and my life as a Christian. And that's a journey that I've been on for 30 years. When I was 25, I'm now 55. So that moment has shaped my journey and has given me a stable foundation for a following of Jesus ever since. But I know from stories like the Joseph story and from my own experience that God's love and God's goodness are there. They are true. God's love and God's goodness are true. That his power, his imagination, his creativity are at work for my good. His power, his imagination, his creativity are at work for your good, for our good. Even when we can't see them. And even when they're only clearest to us in retrospect as we look back on where we've come from. In the meantime, God's invitation to us is to keep trusting him, to remain faithful to the word that we understand, to keep honoring him with our choices. And that's why I say we usually understand God's direction more clearly in hindsight than we do in the moment. And now for those of you who haven't heard anything I've said since I introduced the little puzzle to you, I said that Joseph is one of two main characters in the Old Testament about whom almost nothing negative is said. The other person I had in mind was Daniel. You might find me out on this, but I think if you read through, if you think about the characters, those two are the ones about whom really nothing negative is said. I want to close today by reminding you of this memory verse I've suggested to you from Psalm 73 as we continue through the But God series. The psalmist there says, my flesh and my heart may fail, but God is the strength of my heart and my portion forever. My flesh and my heart may fail, but God is the strength of my heart and my portion forever. And this morning we might add, because God knows what's coming and God knows what to do. Thanks be to God. Amen.